In a society obsessed with getting tough on crime, Russell Marks's provocative examination of Australia's criminal justice system couldn't be more timely. A favorite among progressive legal scholars and criminal justice reformers, this book has quietly influenced policy discussions across Australia since its publication. When Barack Obama visited Australia in 2019, a copy was reportedly included in his welcome package by justice reform advocates. The book's central premise, that punishment often fails both victims and offenders, challenges our most basic assumptions about justice in ways that have sparked heated debates from university classrooms to parliamentary chambers. As crime rates continue to fall while prison populations surge, Marx asks a question that should trouble us all. What if our entire approach to criminal justice is fundamentally flawed? The disconnect between public perception and criminal justice reality begins with media manipulation, a phenomenon that shapes policy far more than empirical evidence. Consider the case that opens the book. A 20-year-old who assaulted an elderly man received a community corrections order rather than jail time. The Herald Sun's misleading headline, "Grandfather Attacker Walks Free," ignited predictable outrage, despite the fact that the offender faced significant supervision, rehabilitation requirements, and imprisonment if he failed to comply. The magistrate had thoughtfully considered the offender's diagnosed ADHD, intellectual disability, and violent upbringing, factors the public rarely hears about. Similar cases across Australia demonstrate how nuanced judicial decisions are routinely reduced to inflammatory headlines that obscure the complex reality of criminal justice. This pattern, sensationalist media stoking public outrage, which then influences government policy, has accelerated a tough-on-crime approach across Australia. Despite falling crime rates, prison populations surged 9% in just 1 year, 2013-2014, with mandatory minimum sentences proliferating nationwide. In Victoria alone, changes to parole laws led to a 25% increase in the prison population between 2013 and 2016. Politicians have learned that appearing tough on crime wins votes, regardless of whether these policies actually reduce crime or rehabilitate offenders. This political calculation has led to billions spent on new prisons while rehabilitation programs remain chronically underfunded. What's lost in this cycle is the profound social consequences of mass incarceration, damaged families when parents are jailed, unemployment upon release, untreated health issues, and disproportionate impacts on Indigenous people, who comprise over 25% of Australia's prison population, despite being only 3% of the general population. Studies show that children with incarcerated parents are 6 times more likely to end up in prison themselves, perpetuating an intergenerational cycle of disadvantage. When prisoners are released, finding employment becomes nearly impossible. 75% of employers admit they would not hire someone with a criminal record. Medical and mental health problems go unaddressed inside prison, with over 40% of inmates suffering from mental illness, and the rigid atmosphere fails to prepare inmates for independent living. The tragedy is that this system persists not because it works, but because it satisfies our emotional desire for retribution. Research consistently shows that increased imprisonment rates have minimal impact on crime rates, yet Australia spends over $3.4 billion annually on corrections. We've created a justice system that prioritizes punishment over problem-solving, vengeance over rehabilitation, and political expediency over evidence-based approaches. Countries like Norway, with their focus on rehabilitation and low recidivism rates, demonstrate that alternatives exist. But changing course requires confronting uncomfortable truths about our current system and challenging deeply held beliefs about crime and punishment. The question remains, are we willing to embrace evidence-based reform, or will we continue to let fear and headlines drive our justice policy? Imagine entering a magistrate's court as a defendant. You pass through airport-style security scanners into a world of imposing counters, stern-faced officials, and overwhelming bureaucracy. The building itself speaks of authority: high ceilings, wooden panels, and formal portraits of judges past. If you're middle class and educated, you might be the only person besides the magistrate and lawyers wearing formal attire. Everyone else wears track pants, hoodies, and runners. This visual distinction immediately separates respectable citizens from criminals before any case is heard, creating an implicit bias that permeates the entire proceedings. The court process itself creates nearly insurmountable barriers for disadvantaged defendants. Consider Nigel, an 18-year-old with a violent, absent father and alcoholic mother who spent his teenage years bouncing between relatives' homes. His fingerprint was found on a DVD case inside a burglarized house, circumstantial evidence that wouldn't typically secure a conviction in a properly defended case. Yet the pressure to plead guilty begins at arrest and continues relentlessly throughout the process, manifesting in subtle and overt ways. The police interrogation creates an illusion of transparency while masking unrecorded interactions. Officers might say things like, "It'll go better for you if you cooperate," or "The judge will look favorably on an early guilty plea," statements that sound helpful but serve to circumvent proper legal process. At court, institutional pressure pushes toward guilty pleas for efficiency's sake. Without money for a private lawyer, Nigel relies on an overworked duty lawyer who might see 15-20 cases that morning alone. Due to legal aid funding cuts, he doesn't qualify for representation since he's unlikely to face prison as a first-time offender, a catch-22 that leaves him vulnerable to poor legal outcomes. The uncertainty of adjournments often drives defendants to plead guilty just to get it over with. Each appearance means another day off work, if employed, childcare arrangements, and transportation costs. When approaching prosecutors, they'll likely spend mere minutes reviewing his case before dismissing his defense with misleading statements like, "Fingerprints don't last very long," or "We have witnesses ready to testify," pressure tactics that exploit defendants' limited legal knowledge. This system operates like a revolving door, trapping defendants in cycles of punishment rather than rehabilitation. Consider Angus, a 19-year-old homeless meth addict who committed burglary to fund his addiction. After admitting to 5 burglaries, he faces jail time for both these new crimes and breaching his previous community corrections order by missing appointments while living on the streets. The classical villain approach assumes punishment deters future crime and that offenders freely choose their actions. But this model fails Angus. Jail will only connect him with more experienced criminals while providing no practical skills for reintegration, drug treatment, or stable housing. Even community-based orders maintain the same punitive framework: attend appointments or else. This sets up vulnerable people for failure by demanding perfect compliance regardless of their circumstances, mental health issues, addiction, homelessness, or lack of transportation. The system measures attendance rather than actual progress, labeling missed sessions as non-compliance rather than potential symptoms of underlying issues that need addressing. Success is defined by bureaucratic metrics rather than meaningful life changes, perpetuating cycles of disadvantage and reoffending. The reality of criminal offenders bears little resemblance to comic book villains. Young, homeless, addicted Angus and neglected, abused Nigel don't match the sociopathic criminals portrayed in popular media. These real-life cases reveal complex individuals shaped by circumstances rather than inherent evil. This portrayal of criminals as villains allows us to see them as irredeemable others rather than people we might become in similar circumstances, a comfortable fiction that absolves society of deeper responsibility. Understanding crime requires distinguishing between interconnected forms of disadvantage. Poverty, income below a poverty line, manifests in immediate material hardship, while deprivation, lack of resources preventing access to essentials, creates chronic instability in housing, nutrition, and basic needs. Social exclusion, measured by activities people can't participate in, compounds these challenges by cutting people off from support networks and opportunities. Some laws directly criminalize poverty, like those against public begging, sleeping rough, or fare evasion. While social security systems theoretically provide a safety net, Byzantine bureaucratic requirements, from complex paperwork to rigid reporting schedules, often prevent the neediest from accessing vital assistance. Many assume poverty results from poor choices, ignoring how being raised by parents with multiple and complex needs severely limits one's prospects from birth. Children growing up in disadvantaged households often lack basic stability, proper nutrition, educational support, and positive role models. Social exclusion cuts disadvantaged people off from opportunities the middle class takes for granted: employment prospects, travel, sports, quality food, public transport, childcare, healthcare, and housing. Even basic activities like opening a bank account or securing rental housing become nearly impossible hurdles. The more markers of disadvantage one has, the more excluded they become from these basic aspects of Australian life, creating a self-reinforcing cycle. The relationship between race and crime powerfully illustrates how disadvantage is misunderstood. Rather than being culturally inherent, Indigenous overrepresentation stems from environmental factors like remote community isolation, internal impacts, intergenerational trauma, and community legacies of colonization and racist policies. Trauma trails from forced removals across generations have created compounding harms affecting family structures, cultural transmission, and community cohesion. Contemporary racism further exacerbates these disadvantages through discrimination in housing, employment, and criminal justice. Yet public discourse often simplistically attributes Indigenous incarceration to individual choices rather than this complex historical context. Magistrates' courts are filled with people bearing multiple, overlapping markers of disadvantage. Drug use, alcohol dependency, gambling debts, family breakdown, childhood abuse, mental illness, disability, homelessness, domestic violence, poverty, and unemployment. These factors frequently cluster together, creating nearly insurmountable barriers to stability. While courts now acknowledge disadvantage in sentencing, they still operate within a punishment framework that fails to address the root causes of criminal behavior. Without addressing underlying social determinants, the cycle of disadvantage and crime continues unbroken across generations. Why do we punish? The obvious answers: because offenders deserve it, to hold them accountable, to deter future crime, rely heavily on hope rather than evidence. Our criminal justice system operates on legal precedent rather than empirical evidence about human behavior. While science and criminology rely on systematic research and data analysis, courts follow constitutional rules, parliamentary laws, and legal precedent that may not reflect the best available evidence about what actually works. This disconnect between evidence and practice has created a system that perpetuates ineffective approaches to crime prevention and rehabilitation. Samuel Butler's 1872 satirical novel Erewhon depicted a society where criminals were treated as ill and sick people were sentenced as criminals. This thought-provoking reversal highlighted the arbitrary nature of how society categorizes and responds to harmful behaviors. The idea that criminality could be cured rather than punished has ancient roots in Greek and Roman philosophy, but resurged as empirical knowledge about human behavior developed through psychology, sociology, and neuroscience. For the past century, the classical criminal justice model has faced increasing challenges from social sciences, which emphasize environmental factors, mental health, and socioeconomic conditions in criminal behavior. Prisons are officially justified as enhancing public safety and reducing reoffending, following an intuitive logic. Removing criminals from society protects the public, while punishment deters both offenders and potential offenders. While imprisonment rates have increased dramatically, 64% between 1985-2009, evidence suggests prison works primarily through containment rather than deterrence or rehabilitation. Studies across multiple countries show that a 10% rise in imprisonment reduces serious crime by only 2-4%. And most troublingly, prison time actually increases recidivism risk through factors like criminal networking, institutionalization, and reduced employment prospects. Research indicates that first-time offenders are particularly vulnerable to these negative effects. The economic burden is staggering and difficult to justify given these poor outcomes. Housing an adult prisoner costs over $300 daily, $100,000 plus annually, while youth detention exceeds $600 daily, $230,000 annually, figures that continue to rise with inflation and increased security measures. Australia spent $14 billion on police, courts, and corrections in 2013, with $2.4 billion allocated to 114 custodial facilities alone. This massive expenditure includes staffing, infrastructure maintenance, healthcare, and security systems. Community corrections programs, which supervise twice as many offenders as prisons, receive just one-fifth of prison funding, despite showing better outcomes in terms of rehabilitation and cost-effectiveness. Justice reinvestment advocates argue diverting minimum security prisoners to community programs could save hundreds of millions while addressing crime's root causes through education, mental health treatment, and job training. Yet governments continue building expensive new prisons, creating sunk costs that incentivize incarceration to justify the investment. Private security multinationals like G4S, GO, and Serco profit enormously from prison expansion, with some companies reporting billions in annual revenue from correctional services. Meanwhile, politicians benefit from tough-on-crime platforms despite mounting evidence that imprisonment fails both society and victims, creating a cycle of political incentives that perpetuate ineffective policies. Recent studies suggest that investing in prevention and rehabilitation programs could yield returns of up to $7 for every dollar spent compared to the negative returns of traditional incarceration.
Critics often challenge criminal justice reformers by asking, "What about the victims?" This valid question highlights a common perception that defense lawyers protect bad people at victims' expense. However, we can simultaneously address both victims' and offenders' needs through a more nuanced and comprehensive approach to justice that recognizes the complexity of crime and victimization. Contrary to popular perception, victims and offenders typically come from the same disadvantaged communities, sharing similar socioeconomic backgrounds and environmental challenges. Indigenous people are overrepresented among victims, just as they are among offenders, often facing rates of victimization 3-4 times higher than non-Indigenous populations. Most homicide victims know their attackers. Studies show that approximately 70% of murders involve people who had prior relationships. Victims of sexual offenses are typically young, with data indicating that women between 16 and 24 years old face the highest risk. Property crime follows the principle of least resistance, targeting less secured possessions rather than well-alarmed wealthy homes, making economically disadvantaged neighborhoods more vulnerable. Many offenders have themselves been victims of crime, particularly childhood abuse and neglect, which correlates strongly with later criminality. Research suggests up to 80% of incarcerated individuals experienced some form of childhood trauma. In the classical criminal justice model, victims serve primarily as information sources rather than active participants in their pursuit of justice. Once police take a victim's statement, many victims feel abandoned by the system, left to navigate complex legal procedures without adequate support or guidance. Crimes are treated as offenses against public order rather than against individuals, leaving victims disconnected from the process that supposedly serves their interests. While victim impact statements are now permitted during sentencing, they typically result in harsher sentences rather than healing or restoration, often leaving victims feeling instrumentalized rather than heard. Building public policy on victims' anger and moral outrage leads to longer sentences and more prisons, but no reduction in crime rates, a pattern observed across multiple jurisdictions. Politicians find it easier to promote punitive approaches than evidence-based responses to moral panics, as demonstrated by the rapid passage of mandatory minimum sentences following high-profile cases. Former Attorney General Rob Hulls noted how much easier it is to demand tougher sentences on camera than to explain investments in prevention and rehabilitation, highlighting the political challenges of evidence-based reform. The adversarial justice system treats victims as witnesses whose testimony faces aggressive cross-examination, often leaving them traumatized and reluctant to engage with the justice system again. In sexual assault cases especially, victims endure invasive medical examinations, repeated questioning about traumatic events, and persistent skepticism about their credibility. Studies show that less than 40% of sexual assault victims report their assault, largely due to fear of this process. When defendants are found not guilty, victims often interpret this as "the court didn't believe me," leading many to internalize frustration that manifests as depression or even suicide. Research indicates that sexual assault victims are 13 times more likely to attempt suicide than the general population. Taking victims seriously means neither excluding them completely nor keeping them trapped in rage, but finding ways to meaningfully incorporate them while still pursuing prevention and rehabilitation. This requires developing alternative justice models, such as restorative justice programs, that can better serve both victims' need for healing and society's interest in rehabilitation and crime prevention. David Williamson's powerful play Face to Face demonstrates community conferencing, a restorative justice model that fundamentally reimagines how we address criminal behavior. The play centers on Glenn, a worker facing imprisonment after violently assaulting his foreman and deliberately ramming his boss Greg's car in a fit of rage. Rather than proceeding through traditional criminal courts, Glenn participates in a carefully structured conference bringing together all parties affected by his actions, including family members, colleagues, and workplace representatives. The conference setting creates a uniquely intimate environment unlike traditional courtrooms. While courts maintain formal distance between victims and offenders through legal representatives, community conferencing enables direct dialogue under skilled facilitation. The facilitator carefully manages the emotional temperature, allowing Greg to directly express his fear and anger while ensuring Glenn can safely acknowledge his actions. This direct encounter proves transformative for both parties in ways rarely possible in conventional legal settings. As the conference unfolds, it reveals a complex web of contributing factors: systemic workplace bullying that had gone unchecked, Glenn's undiagnosed depression and anxiety, and toxic management practices that bred deep resentment among workers. Through guided discussion, participants move beyond the incident itself to understand its broader context. Glenn's initial defensiveness gives way to genuine remorse as he truly grasps the impact of his actions, while others begin to recognize their own roles in enabling a destructive workplace culture. Since 2005, New South Wales has implemented forum sentencing based on similar principles. This approach replaces traditional punitive sentences with collaborative intervention plans developed by victims, offenders, police representatives, and social service providers. These plans often combine multiple elements: formal apologies, financial compensation, community service work, and targeted rehabilitation programs addressing anger management or substance abuse. Early evaluation data has been striking. Between 61 to 76% of victims rated the conferences as very fair, while over 90% of all participants felt their voices were genuinely heard and considered. As the conference unfolds, it reveals a complex web of contributing factors: systemic workplace bullying that had gone unchecked,
Glenn's undiagnosed depression and anxiety, and toxic management practices that bred deep resentment among workers. Through guided discussion, participants move beyond the incident itself to understand its broader context. Glenn's initial defensiveness gives way to genuine remorse as he truly grasps the impact of his actions, while others begin to recognize their own roles in enabling a destructive workplace culture. Since 2005, New South Wales has implemented forum sentencing based on similar principles. This approach replaces traditional punitive sentences with collaborative intervention plans developed by victims, offenders, police representatives, and social service providers. These plans often combine multiple elements: formal apologies, financial compensation, community service work, and targeted rehabilitation programs addressing underlying issues like anger management or substance abuse. Early evaluation data has been striking. Between 61 to 76% of victims rated the conferences as very fair, while over 90% of all participants felt their voices were genuinely heard and considered. Other innovative alternatives have shown equally promising results. Indigenous Koori courts, which incorporate Aboriginal elders and cultural practices into proceedings, have achieved a 50% reduction in reoffending rates. Specialized drug courts, focusing on rehabilitation over punishment, generate $5.80 in social benefit for every dollar invested through reduced recidivism and healthcare costs. Neighborhood justice centers provide accessible mediation services that resolve conflicts before they escalate to criminal behavior. These approaches succeed by slowing down the justice process, allowing time for deeper engagement and coordinated support services. They create space for community wisdom, cultural healing practices, and evidence-based interventions that address root causes rather than just symptoms. The results consistently show reduced reoffending, improved victim satisfaction, and significant cost savings compared to traditional incarceration. However, despite 15 years of documented success, these alternatives remain limited in Australia, constrained by tough-on-crime political rhetoric that prioritizes punitive approaches. Particularly concerning was the closure of specialized programs like Perth SafeCare and NSW's Cedar Cottage, which provided treatment-focused alternatives for sexual offenders. Cedar Cottage had achieved remarkable results, reducing sexual reoffending by more than 50% compared to prison sentences, yet was shut down by coalition governments responding to public pressure for harsher punishment. These closures represent a tragic prioritization of retribution over healing, particularly for young victims. Traditional court processes often re-traumatize children through aggressive cross-examination and adversarial proceedings. Meanwhile, the classical justice model's focus on punishment creates perverse incentives for offenders to deny responsibility rather than engage in genuine accountability and change. Alternative approaches that emphasize rehabilitation and restoration might encourage more admissions of guilt and meaningful reform, while better serving victims' needs for healing and closure. The case of Wayne illustrates the system's fundamental flaws. On parole, after making significant progress, attending anger management programs, participating in men's shed groups, and mentoring a teenager, Wayne was immediately returned to prison when his wife claimed he had assaulted her during an argument. Despite weak evidence and his wife's attempts to withdraw the complaint, Wayne remained incarcerated, losing access to rehabilitation programs due to frequent transfers within the overcrowded system. Meanwhile, his wife struggled without his help with their children and his income contribution toward rent. Child protection officers ironically noted they had felt more comfortable when Wayne was around, as his influence had recently been assessed as positive. When Wayne's original sentence expired before the new charges were resolved, he entered a guilty plea simply to begin serving his sentence in a proper facility rather than remand. What this family received wasn't help, but a system determined to follow its rules regardless of consequences, a system focused on punishment rather than problem solving. The author identifies four fundamental problems with the classical criminal justice model: prisons don't rehabilitate effectively, the system punishes based on offender agency, then denies that agency during incarceration, indigenous incarceration rates have increased since the 1991 Royal Commission, and the punishment method further entrenches alienation and social exclusion. Society faces a choice: continue getting tougher on offenders despite the growing financial costs and social consequences, or embrace justice reinvestment by addressing the root causes of disadvantage and dysfunction. Most court defendants aren't comic book villains, but people struggling with multiple forms of disadvantage. Their criminality is a symptom of societal failure that society has a responsibility to address. A truly innovative approach would incorporate philosopher John Ralston Saul's six essential human qualities: common sense, ethics, imagination, intuition, memory, and reason. Employing just one quality while neglecting others leads to disastrous outcomes. Our current system overemphasizes reason and punishment while neglecting ethics, imagination, and common sense. By reimagining justice as problem-solving rather than punishment, we might create a system that truly serves victims, rehabilitates offenders, and builds safer communities, all while saving billions in taxpayer dollars. The evidence is clear. We know what works. The only question is whether we have the political courage to embrace it.